We want to switch gears now. Tomorrow is Black Friday, as you probably know. That's when many stores offer massive discounts to shoppers who are willing to wait in huge lines and sometimes get into brawls in those lines. It's such a boon for businesses that many stores are turning it into Black Thursday. They're opening their doors tonight. With smartphones and tablets, though, more and more shoppers are buying gifts online. They're comparing prices online and then charging items straight to their credit cards on the fly using apps on their mobile device. Here to talk to us about that, one of our money coaches, NPR senior business editor Marilyn Giwax. We turn to her regularly for advice on economics and personal finance. Marilyn, welcome back to the program.
Hi, it's great to be here.
So tell us how big this segment is of people who are choosing to shop online as opposed to in the physical store.
Think about it. This really got started in 1995. Now, to me, that's not all that long ago. Amazon started out with selling books online, and then they pretty quickly moved into CDs, software, games, jewelry. And then pretty soon, everybody capitulated, and traditional stores like Sears, Walmart, they all switched to Sears.com, Walmart.com. So, you know, it really grew dramatically. In fact, at first, most employers were trying to use blocking technologies to keep employees from shopping during work hours. Now only about a third do that because they know perfectly well that even if your computer is blocked, you can pull out your smartphone and keep shopping anyway.
Well, since you mentioned smartphones, there is a distinct difference between online shopping, where you're just sitting at home, right, and shopping from your desktop. And then there's people who actually take their smartphones in with them to compare prices and find deals and even look at reviews before they buy a product, right?
Exactly. You know, the image of an online shopper just a couple of years ago was a woman sitting at home in front of her home computer after the kids went to bed and trying to do some shopping then. Today, the image of a shopper is you're waiting to get your hair cut and you're shopping with your handheld device. It's really changed the way people interact with shopping because they've got this, in effect, little computer right there in their hand.
Many physical retailers may not be happy about this concept of showrooming, right? I mean, because it turns out people are going into stores, they find a product they like, they look online, they either see reviews
that,
yeah, or they find a better price online, right? And so they decide to go home and purchase it from the online store instead of the physical store.
You can understand how frustrating that has to be to a merchant. You know, you've got to pay all those bills to keep the lights on, keep the floors polished. You display things nicely on your store shelves in your showroom. And then people, I don't want to say me, but
you just
people,
did.
But some
okay.
people might come in, take a look at what you see in the store, and then, you know, step out to go get a cup of coffee and pull out your smartphone and do some comparison shopping and see if that's really the right choice for you. And it puts a lot of pressure on the merchants. They have to compete, so there's a lot of pricing pressure. And you see that in the data. This year, the analysts are projecting that retail sales altogether will be up only about 4%. And that's not that much. This is looking like a somewhat disappointing year. It's not so much that people won't be shopping, but just that the sales won't be that high because they can't raise prices.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Celeste Headlee. We're gearing up for holiday shopping by looking at the ins and outs of shopping on a mobile device. We're talking with NPR's senior business editor, Marilyn Giwax. You know, I found it interesting that a grocery store like Safeway, for example, has a mobile app called Just For You. And in that particular case, it's more than the loyalty card thing, right? If you sign up for this mobile app, you get even bigger coupons that nobody else gets. You have to have the mobile app to do that. So I wonder, who are the winners and losers in that equation?
Merchants understand how people are shopping. They see people walking around with those smartphones. They know that this has become part of people's lives, of having a cell phone in your hand. And they're right to think that. 9 out of 10 people have some sort of cell phone. And, you know, at first you might think that this is something that discriminates against the poor because you would think
they
that
may not have smartphones.
They may not have a smartphone. But what the data is showing is that poor people are dropping their landlines. They don't have a hardwired phone at home. They don't have an expensive computer at home. But they do invest in having access to the internet because they know it's important for themselves, for their kids. So even poorer families are moving towards smartphones because there are cheap models out there. And it's their all-in-one package. It's the family computer. It's the family phone. So we're seeing that poor people actually do kind of have access to those coupons, but where there's a bigger divide is age, because older people may have a cell phone in their purse, But they use it to make phone calls. So they're not as sophisticated with using
phones. Make phone calls on your smartphone.
Taking a phone and using it to place phone calls. Younger people just know more instinctively, or they've just kind of grown up with it, and they know how to find those bargains on their smartphones in ways that older people don't.
Are people more likely to overspend when they're shopping online than when they're in a physical store?
It's pretty darn easy to shop online. On the one hand, that's very convenient. On the other hand, there's something to be said for that old-fashioned way of going into the store, putting it on layaway. You don't take the thing home until you can really afford it and it's been paid off. One-click shopping with a handheld device at 3 in the morning is a good way to get yourself into trouble. Now, you know, in a larger sense of what is this all doing to the economy, you know, this shift to online shopping is changing in some ways what happens at Christmas in terms of hiring. Retail stores, as I said, they have all this pressure to hold down prices, so they're tighter with their hiring. But the delivery companies...
Yeah, FedEx needs lots of people.
They need a lot of people. UPS says that it plans to add 55,000 workers for the holiday season. It's an awful lot of people moving packages back and forth, you know, putting them onto the trucks, unloading them. And that's really an area of growth for the economy. But one last point I want to make about these deliveries. You know, that's someplace where there's a financial divide for people. That is, richer people tend to live in safer neighborhoods. But for a lot of people, that last step in the online shopping process, that is having a package sitting on your front porch all day, is really a problem. There are just many more concerns about somebody just picking up your box. So one of the things the delivery companies are trying to do is they're texting and emailing you or alerting you in some way that a package will be delivered the next day so that you can either reroute it or tell them, wait, give me one more day, or you can get a relative to help you receive that box. So that's one of the points that slows down online sales.
That's interesting. That was NPR Senior Business Editor Marilyn Giewack. She joined us from our Washington studio. Happy shopping, Marilyn. Thanks so much.
Oh, you're welcome.
As we charge into the holiday gift-buying season, gadgets are usually near the top of many people's wish lists. Our regular technology commentator, Rich Jaroslawski of Bloomberg News, tells us about his gadget picks for 2012. Rich, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
First, Rich, let's look at the camera. It's an amazing little machine. It doesn't even vaguely look like a camera. It looks like it must be expensive and do lots of clever tricks.
Well, it costs about $400, and the most clever trick that it does, at least for me, is that it allows you or anybody viewing your picture online to refocus it after the fact. The camera captures so much information that when you look at it on screen, if you see that, oh my gosh, I accidentally focused on the ball when I wanted to focus on the kid, simply by clicking on the photo, the entire photo refocuses around whatever you've clicked on.
So what's the advantage here? Do you think it's that you can take artful pictures or that you just can't mess anything up?
Well, I think it depends a lot on the photographer. For the advanced photographer, there are a lot of advanced tools that let you customize it. But for the typical everyday photographer, I think at least that the big advantage is it's basically idiot-proof. You can't ruin a picture anymore.
Okay. Now, you also sent us a set of headphones, very sleek and comfortable, and they are wireless. We connected them to an iPhone wirelessly. I took a little walk around the office, and I was listening all the way. So super convenient, I guess, for listening around the house or maybe in our noisy radio office.
Well, they are super convenient. They're called the Zik wireless headphones. They're about $400, and they were designed by Philippe Starck, the well-known product designer, who, among other things, worked with Steve Jobs on the design of his yacht. And these are noise-canceling headphones that have more technology in it than a nuclear submarine, I think. Among other things, one of the ear cups is actually a touchpad, so you can control everything wirelessly simply by sliding your finger back and forth along the touchpad. You can increase the volume. You can skip to the next song. It also has Bluetooth connectivity, as you pointed out, so that, you know, you're not tethered to your device. If you take a phone call that comes in while you're wearing the Zicks, there are microphones built into the headphones, so you can simply take a phone call without doing anything more than tapping your ear.
And now, our favorite gadget. We at Morning Edition live on coffee, so This is a coffee machine which costs a boatload of money, and it appears to be somewhat smarter than I am. I mean, tell us what it does.
Well, this is the Seiko Excelsis Digital ID coffee maker, and it retails for around $3,000.
Whoa.
And for $3,000, you would expect it to make pretty good coffee, and it does. But the thing that I kind of fell in love with was the biometric digital fingerprint reader. The idea behind this is that the coffee maker can store up to 6 different user profiles, and you can tell a coffee maker exactly how you want your coffee, how strong you want the beans ground, how much water, how much milk, and you can save all that to your personal profile with your fingerprint. And then, you know, when you stumble into the kitchen every morning, all you have to do is swipe your finger over the top of the coffee maker, and it immediately recognizes you and brews your favorite cup.
I have to say that my favorite thing about this is its noises. Since this is a radio program, let's just let you listen to what this thing would say to you in the morning if you drifted up to it and made a cup of coffee. Rich Jaroslawski, he joined us from Palo Alto in California. Rich, thank you very much for all these additions to my wish list.
Well, thank you for having me.
Rich Jaroslawski is a columnist for Bloomberg News.
Of course, to have e-books, you have to have power. So now to some new technology for generating it. Spanish engineers found a way to harness the power of big waves. Europe's first wave-powered electricity plant is off Spain's north coast in the Bay of Biscay, which is notorious for its huge surf. Lauren Freyer sent this report.
Waves constantly thrash the fishing village of Mutricu on Spain's north coast. Records from the 13th century describe the dangerous surf and shipwrecks here. Until recently, water occasionally hurled debris through windows of homes before the local government built a cement breakwater to shelter the harbor. Now this town's few thousand residents have a small beach that's protected from raucous waves that roll in off the Bay of Biscay. They can stroll down a pier and out over the breakwater. And hidden underneath their feet, Spanish scientists like Gloria Echevarria are busy generating electricity from these powerful waves.
The government decided to build a breakwater to protect the harbor of Mutricu. And so, making use of that decision, we decided to put there our wave energy plant.
Echevarria is a renewable energy technician who specializes in marine power, electricity generated from tides or waves. It's a relatively young industry that Spain is exploring after investing heavily in solar and wind power for decades. Echevarria guides me inside Mutricu's breakwater, a hollow cement and stone structure more than 4 football fields long. Inside are 16 turbines that spin inside chambers with each wave that rolls in. They use technology called OWC, oscillating water columns. Echevarria explains.
We have some chambers, and when the wave arrives, the wave pushes, compresses the air inside the chambers. So the air goes through a turbine and drives it, that in turn drives an alternator, so producing electricity.
Salt water would corrode the turbines pretty quickly and require expensive repairs, but the water doesn't touch them. It's only air pushed by the waves underneath. The Mutricu plant connected its turbines to Spain's power grid 2 summers ago, making it Europe's first commercial wave plant. Since then, similar technology has been used in Scotland and the Azores. The plant cost the regional government just under $3 million to build, beyond the cost of the breakwater, which was going to be built anyway. It has a capacity of about 300 kilowatts, supplying power to about 600 residents. That's very small compared to Spain's wind and solar capacity, which on sunny, windy days can generate up to 70% of the country's electricity. But just like Spain's construction bubble, there's been a renewable energy bubble here too, which popped when Spanish lawmakers slashed the budget back in January, says Gonzalo Escribano, an energy economist at Madrid's Elcano Royal Institute.
Because we got a bubble, mainly in the solar power. What they said in January is, now we got a moratoria. What does it mean, moratoria? Moratoria means no new installation will receive support. That's it.
In the boom years, the Spanish government offered generous subsidies for renewable energy. Now those are gone. So big, expensive solar plants aren't as attractive as small-scale experimental projects like the Mutriku wave plant. Ironically, the economic crisis could mean a blossoming of different types of renewable energy here, now that subsidies for wind and solar are gone, Escribano says.
You got a lot of energy sources, and you will need all of them. You will need conventional, you will need new energies, and the more you got from anything, the best, you know. So you have to pursue all the paths. Perhaps in some ways, in some technologies, your path is leading nowhere, but you will never know until you're there.
It took Spain's wind energy industry about 30 years to get close to being competitive with natural gas, so it could be decades before we know how successful wave power might be here. Spain is desperately searching for an industry to replace all the jobs lost when the construction sector collapsed. Unemployment tops 25%. Juan Goicolea is the Vice Minister of Innovation and Technology for the Basque Regional Government, which oversees the Mutriku wave plant.
Construction is low capital intensive, high number of jobs. Renewable energy is capital intensive. But in the end, it creates added value that will be recycled through other activities that will create jobs.
The renewable sector hopes to create more than 200,000 green jobs in Spain next year and 3 million across Europe. That won't make up for Spain's lost construction jobs, but it's a start. Back at the Mutriku wave plant, the technician Echevarria says the lean economy can sometimes force scientists to get creative. Government subsidies used to create incentives, but now the field is wide open.
So we are looking for new ways of doing something.
Like stashing high-tech wave energy in a hollow pier and powering the local economy with it. For NPR News, I'm Lauren Freyer.
Support for All Tech Considered comes from Carbonite, providing automatic and encrypted cloud backup solutions for home and small business computers. Learn more at carbonite.com. This is All Things Considered from NPR News.
China is routinely ranked as one of the most repressive nations in terms of press freedoms and free speech. But thanks to a social media site, more Chinese are speaking more freely than ever before. Weibo is China's answer to Twitter. Just 4 years old, it has hundreds of millions of users, and increasingly, Chinese are using it to expose corruption and criticize officials. NPR's Frank Langfitt reports on the Weibo revolution and how China's Communist Party is trying to control it.
Were it not for Weibo, you would never know Tang Wei's extraordinary story. She wouldn't be here to tell it. She'd be sitting in a Chinese re-education through labor camp eating porridge. Instead, Tang's back home at her dining room table in Hunan province, sharing her Kafkaesque tale. It began 6 years ago when a pimp lured her then 11-year-old daughter into a brothel in the central Chinese city of Yongzhou.
He said, "If you cry, I'm going to go kill your mom. I know where your mother's business is, and I know your mother."
The fifth grader was forced to service scores of clients. After 3 months, Tang got a tip about her daughter's location and called the cops. But Tang says the first officer to arrive at the brothel never got out of his car. And even after she convinced police to rescue her daughter, they wouldn't arrest anyone.
We demanded that they take notes when interviewing my child. They repeatedly refused. They said this was not a criminal case.
Later, Tang found out why police were so reluctant. The brothel owner had an uncle who was a top official in the local prosecutor's office. A court did eventually convict the brothel staff. But Tang continued to demand punishment for the police who tried to shield them. In August, the police had had enough and called Tang in.
When I arrived at the police station, I saw they had 7 to 8 special forces police there to guard me. They asked me to sit in the chair for interrogation. I spent the night in the chair and didn't sleep at all. The next morning at 7:30, they gave me a paper saying I was going to re-education through labor camp.
For 18 months, no lawyer, no trial, seemingly no hope. But before the cops hauled her off, Tang called her attorney. He posted the news to his Weibo account. Within days, Tang's story had reached more than 30 million Weibo users, and they were furious. A torrent of criticism followed, overwhelming the local police. After 10 days, the state-run China Central Television announced Tang's release. Tang says a few years ago, this couldn't have happened.
Weibo had a very big impact on my situation because our local government tried to cover up this case and not let the public know. But this time, people around China and even around the world found out they put me in labor camp, and the local government couldn't resist so many people's power.
Chinese Weibo basically is first ever in the Chinese history, the public sphere.
Any local news can immediately become national news.
Weibo is a battleground between the authority and the freedom-thinking people.
That's political commentator Michael Ante, Beijing University professor Hu Yong, and Isaac Mao, one of China's first bloggers. Weibo is changing the way Chinese communicate and has become a major source of news here. Hu Yong says Weibo has also become a powerful new tool for ordinary people to protect their rights.
Before the emergence of Weibo, local people, actually, they have very limited channels to try to solve their problems. But Weibo is kind of pressure politics on local government officials.
In recent months, Weibo campaigns have triggered a number of firings. They include officials in Western China who forced a woman to abort her 7-month-old fetus, and a safety chief who was photographed wearing various luxury watches as well as smiling at the scene of a fatal bus accident. Observers call it Weibo justice. Why does China's famously thin-skinned regime put up with such criticism? Michael Ante says when it's directed at local officials, those attacks actually serve the central government.
Chinese have a long time myth that emperor is good, all the thugs are local. So that myth is very important to keep the regime, the legitimacy. So I think Weibo justice is exactly a showcase for the central government to tell the people that, you know, emperor is still good.
On occasion, the party will even allow netizens, or Wang Min, as they're known in Chinese, to attack high-ranking officials it wants to get rid of. That's what happened to then-Chongqing party boss Bo Xilai, who's lobbying for a top post in Beijing and had lots of political enemies. After Bo's police chief hit out in a U.S. consulate this year, Ante says it was open season on Weibo.
2 months, you can joke about, you know, Bo Xilai and Chongqing city, about everything. Weibo become very convenient platform.
The party, though, won't tolerate anything it remotely sees as a threat. Authorities detained a Beijing blogger earlier this month after he jokingly imagined the recent party leadership congress as a horror movie in which the delegates die en masse. Of course, like most Americans, most Chinese don't use Weibo for politics. They use it to pursue their interests and sometimes to help strangers who share them.
My name is Richard Sears, and for the past 22 years now, I've been working on a website of the etymology of Chinese characters.
Sears is a retired computer programmer from Tennessee. He came to China this year to do research for his website, a personal hobby. But he says because of bad information, his tourist visa was canceled in August.
They confiscated my passport. I found myself with 10 days to get out of the country. At that point, I figured I would have to go home and never come back to China.
Sears had one thing going for him.
I had a few friends on Weibo. I didn't realize how many friends I had on Weibo, but I told a couple of my friends about it, and then suddenly, within a couple of days, there were 40,000 retweets.
Job possibilities poured in from Chinese supporters trying to help Sears stay in the country. Last week, Sears arrived back in Beijing with a work visa and a job teaching physics and doing Chinese language research at Beijing Normal University.
Without Weibo, this would have been impossible.
Weibo is still in its infancy. China's government and the microblog companies themselves employ an army of censors every day to manage and shape its growth. Sears isn't sure how Weibo will ultimately evolve, but he thinks the potential is huge. Frank Langfitt, NPR News, Shanghai.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
I'm Melissa Block, and it's time now for All Tech Considered. And in case you hadn't heard, today is Cyber Monday, the Internet's answer to Black Friday. NPR's Steve Henn covers tech and business. He joins us now from Silicon Valley. And Steve, have you been taking full advantage of Cyber Monday?
Well, I actually was doing some work getting ready for this
interview. So not shopping.
No, I haven't been shopping. But I also had a theory that Cyber Monday might not matter that much anymore.
Uh-huh.
You know, so many people I know take their smartphones with them when they go shopping, and they're comparison shopping at stores over Thanksgiving weekend. And I kind of wondered if that meant that Cyber Monday would just disappear. Well, it turns out my theory is totally wrong. Even though more people are using smartphones in sort of brick and mortar shops, Cyber Monday is still a big deal for many of the same reasons that Black Friday is a big deal. It's a chance for shoppers to find bargains, but this time online. So special deals today are driving a lot of people online. Comscore, which tracks internet traffic, expects today to be the biggest online shopping day ever, with something close to $1.5 billion in sales.
Wow.
20% more than last year. So we'll see if they're right. But in the meantime, it's pretty clear that smartphones have already changed the way millions of people shop. They were using them to buy online over the holiday weekend and comparison shop. So that probably took a bite out of sales at brick and mortar stores.
And how are those brick and mortar stores responding to that?
Well, the biggest ones, the most technologically savvy ones, are trying to embrace the smartphone. They've been building apps for a while for their own stores, and they're encouraging customers to use them. And really what they're after is all the kinds of information they can get from your cell phone. For example, Walmart has an app that uses your location information to know which store you're in. And then it knows what merchandise is in the store around you. If something you want's out of stock, then it can guide you to its online store. Other stores actually keep track of how long you have been in their stores, and they'll send you coupons for every few minutes you're there. So all of these apps are really designed to keep customers from wandering, both digitally and physically. And the thing about smartphones that makes them so frightening to retailers, though, is that it makes it so easy for you to wander, at least digitally, and comparison shop almost endlessly just with your thumbs.
And Steve, do you have favorite sites that you go to for comparison shopping?
Yeah, I do. I have a couple. One is called Mylo, and it allows businesses to get their inventories online so you can see what stores around you have in stock. And they've done a really good job of reaching out to small businesses, so I like it for that reason. The other site I like a lot is Decide.com, and this site was built by a computer scientist who studies dynamic pricing. And it tries to predict whether or not the price of certain gadgets and other goods will drop. And then it recommends whether or not it's a good time to buy. So I like this because it uses the same kinds of technologies that big companies have used to get the most money possible from us and uses it for consumers.
To get better deals.
To get better deals, right.
NPR tech correspondent Steve Henn. Steve, thanks so much.
My pleasure.